I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. Welcome to the Executive Access Podcast. Craig Breslow graduated from Yale University in 2002 with a degree in molecular biophysics and biochemistry. He had plans to attend medical school to study orthopedics, but after a successful four-year run with the school's baseball team, he deferred his acceptance to NYU School of Medicine to pursue a pro baseball career. Breslow won a World Series ring with the Red Sox in 2013, the highlight of a 12-year major league career that saw him pitch for seven different teams. Once called the smartest man in baseball by a veteran writer, Breslow began his front office career in 2019, joining the Cubs as the team's director of strategic initiatives. I had a chance to sit down with Breslow at the Cubs spring facility in Mesa, Arizona, before camps shut down due to the coronavirus pandemic. We discussed his decision to choose baseball over medicine, his experience pitching for Team Israel, his move into the front office, and much more. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with the Cubs director of pitching and special assistant to the president and GM, Craig Breslow. But first, a word from our presenting sponsor, Roman.
This past year has shown us that without your health, you have nothing. If you're not well, you can't work, look after yourself, or take care of your family. You can't enjoy the life you've worked so hard to build. That's why you need to prioritize taking care of your long-term health today, before it goes from good to bad to worse. So invest in your long-term health with Forward. Forward is intelligent medicine with a personal touch. Their doctors are dedicated to catching top killers like cancer and heart disease early before it's too late. And catching them early could save you tens of thousands of dollars in the long run. Everyone's health history is different, which is why Forward doctors personalize a health plan with you, based on your genetics, lifestyle, and biometrics to achieve long-term results and ensure nothing gets missed. It's time to invest in a doctor that's invested in you. Go to GoForward.com today to protect your future health. That's GoForward.com. GoForward.com.
Craig, you grew up in Trumbull, Connecticut, about 65 miles from New York. What was your favorite team?
I was a Mets fan. I was a Mets fan growing up. So born in 1980, you know, kind of my childhood took me through the heyday of those, like, mid to late 80s Mets. Gooden and Darling and Strawberry. A lot of guys that were really fun to root for.
That Trumbull team from the Little League World Series must have had a big impact on you. I think you were, what, about 3 years younger than those kids at the time?
Yeah, exactly. So 3 years younger, and interestingly, not many. Actually, none of those guys went on to careers in professional baseball, successful hockey player in Chris Drury.
Be you guy.
But the impact that, you know, that story had on baseball in a small town was pretty lasting. You know, all of a sudden we saw, you know, an uptick in Little League, you know, and we had lights on our field, and we were hosting different tournaments. And so I do think in a lot of different ways it kind of paved the way for Trumbull to become a pretty successful baseball town.
A lot of people might not know this about you, but you went to Yale. You graduated there in 2002 with a degree in molecular biophysics and biochemistry, which is not exactly the typical path for a Major League Baseball player, but you did also play baseball there. Was it a given to you at the time that you wanted to pursue a professional baseball career?
No, I think the way I best explain this is I kind of had the fantasy, like most kids who play baseball, you know, pitching in the big leagues or playing professionally, and I had this kind of more realistic outcome, which was going to be I was going to be a physician. It turns out I got those exactly backwards, but, you know, I loved playing baseball. I was passionate about it. It was definitely my priority above being a student, and I figured that for as long as I could, I would play, and fortunately, that was quite a bit longer than I had anticipated.
The physician part was still in your mind as you embarked on a pro baseball career. You took the MCATs while you were in the minors, right?
I did, yes.
And you scored a 34, 93rd percentile. How difficult was it to study for a test while you were trying to be a pro baseball player as well?
It was difficult at the time, and maybe it's changed a little bit, but, you know, being an Ivy League graduate in professional baseball, I kind of carried this stigma that this was, you know, this was a pretty transient kind of temporary hobby, and at some point things would get difficult and I'd go to med school, I'd go to law school, whatever kind of the course was. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that that behavior, you know, kind of bringing a textbook with me on road trips didn't alienate myself even further. But actually, so Dan Kantrovitz, who was kind of, you know, recently brought on to lead our amateur scouting department, he and I were actually college summer ball teammates, and he remembers me kind of bringing biochemistry books into our clubhouse in the summer leagues and, you know, and kind of prepping for life after baseball. And actually, I ended up deferring from med school for quite a while. You know, and fortunately, this was from NYU, and fortunately, the admissions committee was pretty understanding for a period of time, and then expressed some concern over the just how long it had been since I had ever set foot in a classroom. The counter argument to that for me was when they were no longer willing to grant me a deferment. I think it was 5 or 6 years, some unprecedented amount of time. Was that I was no less prepared to be a doctor 5 years later than I was at the time when I applied. I still knew nothing about medicine. So, you know, from that argument, I felt like just give me the deferment indefinitely. It didn't work out. It wasn't a successful argument, though.
So you're a 26-round pick of the Brewers, play in their minor league system until the middle of 2004. You get released, but you're not ready to quit the game. At that point, you played for the New Jersey Jackals, mm-hmm. the independent Northeast League. Those independent leagues are really far from the major leagues.
Yeah. So
did you consider at that point quitting and saying, okay, let's go to medical school?
Yeah, so I wasn't ready to leave the game, but it seemed like maybe the industry was ready for me too. And if, fortunately, like my Yale baseball experience was great. I made a bunch of really, really close friends, and there were some guys that I could lean on for counsel, and one of those was a good friend of mine named Matt McCarthy, who has actually kind of reached some prominence as an infectious disease specialist, and given kind of where we are, that's relevant. But Matt had been drafted as a senior like me. He was drafted, I think, 6 rounds ahead of me, played one season in rookie ball. We played against each other a number of times, was released out of spring training. And at the time that we spoke, after my being released in 2004, he had matriculated at Harvard Med School. And, you know, I think I envisioned a parallel path for me. I would play baseball for a while. It would be clear that baseball was no longer in my future. I would move on to medical school. And I talked to him about, you know, how he made that decision, how he came to be comfortable with the fact that his baseball career was over. And I can remember as clear as day the conversation that we had, where he said, you know, for me, it was abundantly clear my time in this game was over. You know, and for you, I think you should go to medical school if you're comfortable with the fact that every time you turn on a baseball game, you're going to wonder if that could be you out there on the mound. And that really resonated with me. I just wasn't ready to move on. I felt like I still had something left to give the game. And whenever I talk about my career, this is always like a moment where I kind of walk the line between, you know, like being honest with yourself, being a good self-evaluator, and also having kind of borderline delusional confidence that it takes to be a successful athlete, right? There was the possibility that the Brewers were right, that I was never going to make it to the big leagues, that I was undersized and understuffed, and I was really just treading water until I got, you know, my real life started. But I wasn't ready to accept that. Fortunately, it looks like I was right.
So, play for the Jackals in the Northeast League, and your performance there leads to the Padres signing you for $1?
Yeah, so this is another interesting story that I'm not sure.
You see that, and it sort of stands out.
Yeah, so I apply to medical school. I defer from NYU. I get released. It was actually the 4th of July in 2004. So it's too late for me to matriculate in September of that year. So regardless, even if I decide I'm ready for med school and baseball is behind me, the soonest that I can enroll is September of 2005. So I have both the rest of 2004 and essentially a full 2005 baseball season if I want it.
Right.
And so, as I said, I wanted to continue playing baseball. So I joined the Jackals. Ironically enough, there was a team in the league in New Haven that played at Yale Field. They weren't interested.
So naturally.
So I went to New Jersey. You know, contemplated just kind of playing that season out, you know, maybe getting a job the next year in a lab or something that would better prepare me for this medical school future. But just decided, you know what, next September, more than likely I'm in medical school. Let me just enjoy baseball. This gives me a year and a half. That will kind of satiate my appetite, right? So the winter going into that 2005 season, one of the scouts for the Padres calls and says, you know, they noticed my performance in the Northeast League, and they host a tryout before spring training for independent league performers, and they were interested in me coming out to that. So essentially, you know, if you think of spring training as a tryout, right, this was a tryout for a tryout.
Right.
And so I wasn't really sure. I kind of deliberated over that. And ultimately what I told them was more than likely I was going to be in medical school a year and a half from that time. I wasn't really sure that kind of getting myself back into this professional baseball mix was what I was interested in. They kind of told me to pump the brakes and said they were just bringing me out for a tryout, right? And here I am telling them that I'm declining their invitation to the big leagues, right?
Right.
And so ultimately we had a bunch of conversations. I agreed to go out for this, you know, 2-day workout. and it was probably the two best days of my life in terms of my pitching performance. So they invite me back to spring training, and now I have another decision to make. And it's funny because a lot of the Padres front office and field staff were guys that I would ultimately run back into later on. So Bill Brick was the field coordinator. Ty Waller, who ended up being the bench coach in Oakland when I made it to the big leagues with Oakland, was the farm director. And so I blatantly told them that I was willing to come back to spring training, but if I didn't make the AA team out of spring training, I was just going to go home, finish out the year and with the Jackals and move on to medical school. And I think that probably came across with a sense of entitlement that I wasn't looking to portray. I legitimately was not insisting that I deserved to go to AA.
Right.
You know, after having been released out of A-ball, very rarely do you get fired and then insist on a promotion. But I just felt like I would have been, you know, potentially 25 years old, in A-ball, with this Ivy League degree, with a medical school deferment, and it just didn't make a ton of sense, right? And so we kind of wrestled back and forth, and ultimately I agreed to go to spring training. I found out at this point, having, again, kind of been reunited with some of those guys, that they were very much like, who does this person think he is? There's no way that this guy, you know, having a 7 ERA out of A-ball is coming in and going to make our AA team. And I told them multiple times through camp that, you know, I didn't believe I was getting the raw end of a deal. I didn't believe I was getting, you know, drawing the short straw. It was just that this is where I felt like I needed to be if this
right.
was going to be worthwhile. And so I have a great spring training. They, you know, kind of put the Padres put some pressure on me to kind of renege on the commitment of AA or bust. But I held fast. And, you know, I can remember going into the day that we were supposed to break camp, being the 13th name on a 12-man staff, not really knowing what my future was. They'd asked, you know, would I be willing to stay in extended? Would I be willing to go to high A for, you know, a week or 2 weeks with the guarantee that I would be the first guy, you know, called up from there? And I'd been around long enough to know how that usually works or doesn't work.
Right.
And so the last day we're supposed to break camp, actually a guy tests positive, you know, in a drug test, is suspended, and I end up making the AA team coming out of camp. But because, getting kind of taking this full circle, because the Jackals had still held the rights to my contract, formally those rights needed to be purchased, and they were done so for a dollar.
Oh, pretty good dollar investment by the Padres. On July 23rd of that 2005 season, mm-hmm. you forget AA, you made your big league debut
right.
in Philadelphia. What do you remember about that day?
So I can remember, it would have been the 22nd. Kevin Towers was the Padres GM at the time. He was with us in Mississippi, so I was having a pretty good year in AA. But again, you know, I was still 5'10". I didn't throw 100. You know, pretty unremarkable, but just kind of getting some guys out. The big league club was in Philadelphia. There was a day game. They had played a couple extra inning games previously leading up to that. Our AAA team is in Portland, Oregon. With a Saturday day game coming up for the big league club, there was just no way to get reinforcements all the way across the country in time for the game. So Kevin Towers asked our manager, like, who's the freshest arm you got? Gary Jones was the manager at the time, and he said, Breslow. KT said, who? But I had never met him. We had never spoken.
That makes
you
feel good.
Right. I had never been to big league camp. But I can remember, you know, after the game, manager calling me into his office and asking me, he said, hey, do you think you can pitch in the big leagues? And, you know, we talked earlier, right, about the Ivy League stigma that gets carried around. And so I thought this was some kind of psychological evaluation. What
right.
kind of confidence is it? I said, sure. That was the brilliant answer I could muster up. Sure, sure I can. He said, pack your stuff. You're going to Philadelphia tomorrow. You know, fortunately, Philadelphia is close enough to Trumbull that my family could get down. I had some friends at the game. And, you know, I can remember getting dropped off at the stadium, not knowing where to go in. Robert Fick, a catcher on the Padres at the time, walking by me and noticing my bag and kind of showing me my way in. Later, he threw his shoes at me and thinking I was the bat boy, told me to polish them up. But I pitched that afternoon, had a pretty good big league debut. I think I struck out three guys, Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard, and Jason Michaels. And then after the game, was called back into the manager's office, and still kind of unfamiliar with the way the protocol worked, I assumed that Bruce Bochy was going to tell me what an impressive performance it was from a 24-year-old kid who had been released out of A-ball the year before. But it turns out he was just sending me back down to the minor leagues. So my major league debut lasted all of 24 hours.
Well, all right, but you had more hours to come.
I did.
We'll get back to your baseball career in a minute. In 2008, you started the Strike Three Foundation, nonprofit charity that funds pediatric cancer research. I know when you were a kid, your sister was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. How important was it to you, and what sort of prompted you to actually take that next step and create this foundation?
Yeah, so it's that combination of a personal story, right? You know, cancer in the family. My sister was 13 when she was diagnosed. I was 11, and you know, the typical concerns that an 11-year-old kid should have are not, you know, is my sister going to die of cancer, right? But coupling that with the interest and passion that I've always had for medicine, you know, like we talked about, thinking that my future would include a life as a physician. And so 2008 was the first full season I spent in the big leagues. It was the first time I made an opening day roster, and I felt like, you know, there was a reasonable chance that I wasn't getting to medical school anytime in the near future, and I wanted to remain connected to the medical community. I wanted to try and make an impact in any way that I could.
I've known you for a few years, and I know this foundation is not just... You see a lot of athletes start foundations and they sort of lend their name to it and let other people run it, and that's that. You are intimately involved in the entire operation.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do for you? What's your favorite part of being sort of that closely involved with the foundation?
Sure. I mean, so it's immensely gratifying and fulfilling. And I've gotten a ton of support from friends and family. And, you know, my wife handles many of the day-to-day operations, and my parents are, you know, kind of serve as ad hoc fillers of whatever need comes up, and you know, as I mentioned, some close friends who lend their expertise. So the organization is all volunteer. There's not any key staff member that receives a penny of compensation. That's incredibly gratifying, just knowing that the types of people who are willing to lend their time, you know, and their services, whether that's accounting, legal counsel, marketing, operations, but beyond that, you know, I think the reason you do this is because you realize that your dollars matter and they work, you know, and the breakthroughs that we've had in, you know, in cancer research, and particularly childhood cancer research, you know, has materially changed survival rates. You know, the hospital visits that we do are, you know, obviously incredibly touching and emotional. But I think more important is being able to kind of track funding that we've awarded to an oncologist. And, you know, based on progress reports that we're receiving over time, we're seeing the transition from, you know, an idea born out of a lab that's real, that's, you know, that's transitioned to a clinical trial that's very close to actually saving people's lives. And I think there's very little that can replace that.
And I should note, your sister beat the cancer.
Yes.
She is healthy today.
Yep. Healthy, has two young boys, lives an unrestricted life.
That's wonderful. Go back to baseball. You made stops in Boston, Cleveland, Minnesota, Oakland, and Arizona between 2006 and 2012. You get traded to the Red Sox at the deadline in 2012, and after that half a season, you signed a two-year deal. I believe that was the only multi-year deal of your career?
It was.
What was it like at that moment to know that you had a place that you were going to be for more than one season?
Yeah, it was great. For a lot of reasons, Boston was a place that I wanted to sign a multi-year deal. And, you know, it's impossible for me to kind of quantify the impact that the security and comfort and familiarity of the multi-year deal brought and the impact that had on my performance. But I don't think it's coincidental that 2013 was also my best season. You know, I was playing for nothing other than to help our team win. It wasn't for my next contract. It wasn't for personal achievement or accomplishment. This is where I was going to be. I was close to home. I got married in 2013. Like, it was a phenomenal year, and it was really very, very comfortable. Actually, like, you know, you mentioned the teams that I play for. I would kind of go on to play for some of those all over again. So
right.
The running joke I have kind of with all of those GMs and managers is, right, everybody, they liked me. They just didn't like me enough to keep me around. They liked me enough to kind of bring me back again
right.
later on.
That offseason, the Red Sox also signed a number of kind of mid-level free agents.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Gomes.
I think they're all here.
Right, that's right. They're all with the Cubs now.
Yeah.
David Ross, Ryan Dempster, Johnny Gomes, Shane Victorino, Mike Napoli, Koji Uehara. None of them jumped out as being, you know, sort of the big major free agent signing of that winter, yet they all played a huge role on the field, off the field, with the Red Sox, a team that went on to win the World Series. What seemed to click about that group and that many new people coming in? Sometimes it takes a little while to adjust.
Well, I just think, you know, that's a prime example of not being able to underscore the importance of culture, you know, the importance of pulling for each other, bringing in a bunch of winners. Those terms are probably overused in today's game, but I've been asked a lot about that team, about what's different about that team compared to some other successful teams that I've played on, when we realized we had the chance to do something special. And it is, I mean, I say this with like utmost sincerity and authenticity. The day we got to spring training, guys were talking about when the Duck Boat Parade was going to be planned. Like, that's just how committed this group was to winning and doing it with no ego. And I think you saw that manifest itself on the field, right? every day it was a different guy who got the game-winning hit or recorded the biggest out. And every day it was, you know, a different leader emerging within the clubhouse. And sure, we had some really strong personalities and Ortiz and Pedroia. And we were really, really talented, too. Let's not forget that. But it wasn't always Ortiz getting the big hit, unless it was the postseason we're talking about, right? And it wasn't always, you know, Lester or Koji getting the biggest out on the mound. You know, you can look at, like, Daniel Nava's, like, game-winning home runs. And, you know, there are probably – that might be the World Series team that you can name the fewest number of guys on, and I think that just speaks to kind of the distribution of performance, but also just the willingness to put the team ahead of any individual accomplishment.
You were with the Red Sox organization in 2007. If my research was right, you spent one day on the roster, never pitched in a game, yet you were on the postseason roster.
So I was not on the postseason roster. I don't know where...
Internet fail.
Yes. I don't know where that came from. But so what happened in 2007, which is a story in and of itself, right? So I think it was Ben Cherington, Mike Hazen were kind of overseeing minor leagues. And they basically said... So I was on the 40-man roster. They said, you know, it was September 1st. We're going to bring you up to the big leagues. And we had a meeting about it, which I thought was strange because, you know, September 1st, you just... bring somebody up for the rest of the month, and
right.
That's kind of how it goes. And they said, you know, we have, you know, we've got a young starter. We're not really sure what we're going to get out of him. Our bullpen's a little bit tired. We just want to have some reinforcements. And I was like, that's fine, but, like, we don't really have roster limitations. I don't really understand why we're doing this. But, you know, they kind of just reiterated the point, like, we're not really sure what we're going to get out of our starter. This is his second big league start. We don't know where this is going to go. So Clay Buck also threw a no-hitter in his second big league start. It was September 1st. I sat in the bullpen and I watched it. You know, needless to say, I wasn't needed. Neither was anybody else in the bullpen. But I actually got sent down after the game. So I believe I may hold the distinction of being the only player ever to get a September call down.
And a World Series ring in the same season.
Right.
For one day.
Theo must have felt really bad about that one day.
So I'm sure that 2007 ring, while it's a nice, you know, paperweight to have somewhere, doesn't hold as much meaning for you. You win the World Series in 2013.
And I got to play.
What was it like to actually go through a season, go through that October run, and actually win a World Series, which every player will tell you is their ultimate goal?
Yeah. You know, I kind of joke about, well, in 2013 they let me play. But the reality is, you know, I feel like I was a contributing member to that team on the field and off the field. And, I mean, to date, it's really hard to imagine any career moment kind of catapulting itself past that. And for a lot of reasons, not just winning the World Series in isolation, but winning the World Series in Boston in 2013, when that city really needs something to rally behind, given, you know, the marathon bombing tragedy. You know, I think we talk about sports as a microcosm. We talk about the ability of, you know, athletes and personalities and teams to kind of heal a community. But I'm not sure that I've ever seen a city rally behind a team and a team rally for a city the way that dynamic worked in 2013.
Fast forward 3 years, you finish the 2016 season and you decide you need to do something to better yourself if you want to keep pitching. You go out and spend $3,000 on a Rapsodo machine, which now there are several of them in pretty much every camp, but not something players were using on their own. You worked on improving the movement of your pitches. Did that feel like a radical step for you at the time?
It was. I think it was probably both radical and necessary. If, you know, it's funny, you kind of juxtapose 2016's decision and that process with 2004 getting released, and, you know, just... as we're talking through this, I'm realizing, you know, maybe it wasn't that I was kind of resilient and relentless and committed. Maybe I was just foolish. But, you know, in 2016, I had kind of established a career financially. I had some security. I'd been through the arbitration process. My personal life was stable. I was married and we had a house, and I just wasn't ready to give up. And I thought, if there's anything I could do to extend this window to continue to play, I'd like to try it. And so, I mean, was it radical when you go from, you know, throwing one way or doing something one way for 30-some-odd years and you decide in about a week you're going to completely turn that upside down? I suppose that's radical, but the alternative was being out of baseball.
Right.
So, you know, necessity drives a lot of radical decisions.
That September in 2016, you pitched for Team Israel in the WBC qualifying rounds.
Mm-hmm.
You pulled out of the actual WBC after you signed a minor league deal with the Twins. being one of the few Jewish players in the majors, what did it mean for you to pitch for Team Israel?
That was a great experience. And admittedly, I kind of saw it as an opportunity to stay relevant. I was released in 2016. I had spent time in the minor leagues for the first time since, I think, 2007. And, you know, while I was kind of in parallel working on lowering my arm slot and kind of creating this new repertoire with the help of some technology that had recently emerged on the market, there was also some legitimate concern that people would just assume I was done playing, right? But that experience turned into an incredibly gratifying and fulfilling opportunity. Because there are so few of us, we all kind of know who one another is. You can give kind of a head nod across the field even. But getting the best Jewish players to play on the same team and putting Israel's name on the uniform as opposed to any kind of individual affiliate, it was a really, really powerful moment. And I think just the pride that collectively that group felt was palpable, the support that we had from the community. And then obviously, like, I give a ton of credit to those guys who went on this incredible run in the WBC and have qualified for the Olympics. And I mean, there's definitely a part of me, you know, that kind of feels as though I've missed out on a pretty significant moment. At the same time, I, you know, kind of made that decision when I made the commitment to the Twins to be in camp and try to win a spot on the opening day roster, and fortunately I did. But there's no question that, you know, the stories that I've heard from those guys who are some of my closest friends, and, you know, the documentary, right? And you can see this was more than just a group of guys who came together to play some games. There was just such an emotional investment in baseball, in Israel, in Judaism, in spreading the game, and spreading the game in Israel. It was a really, really cool thing.
You had signed with the Twins that offseason after your Rep Soto experience.
Right.
There were a bunch of teams that were interested mm-hmm. in signing you, and you took a little less money to go to the Twins, part because of Derek Falvey's presence there. He was new there at the time. Mm-hmm. What about him did you admire most?
Yeah. Derek is just one of those guys who's incredibly engaging and compelling and passionate, but with just a level of authenticity that's really unique. And we shared a number of common views just on development, open-mindedness, on curiosity, and so, you know, the conversations that we had, whereas, you know, I was speaking to GMs and talking for 5 or 10 minutes about what the opportunity might look like to make a team, Derek and I were talking for hours about just kind of the state of player development and, you know, the process that I was undergoing, where I had kind of identified some of the best in standard pitches that I was trying to replicate. And so we just connected, and we still stay in touch. But I think he just has that personality, has that effect on people.
It almost seems like one or both of you thought that maybe this would be career you'd pursue after your playing days. You never know.
Potentially.
Your first go around with the Twins had a major impact on your life, thanks to my buddy Lavelle Neal, who dubbed you the smartest man in baseball in 2009. Mm-hmm. That name followed you around for a while.
Right. They sent that to me, and I insist I did not ask for it.
Okay. Yeah. And you said you would never have used it in a game either, right?
No.
That was purely
kind of
play catch glove.
Right, some of the guys there thought it would be funny. But, I mean, whatever I can do to avoid kind of debunking that nickname, I'm happy with. Right, there's plenty of worse things that athletes are being called these days.
I was going to say, I mean, it was a running gag and people gave you a hard time, but right. There are worse things you can be called than the smartest man in baseball, right?
Absolutely.
Better that than the dumbest man in baseball.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. I just don't want to prove anyone wrong. I just don't want to prove Lavelle wrong, right? So I try to limit my exposure.
You finished 2017 with Cleveland, then spent 2018 in the minor league system with Toronto. Age of 37, you decided after 18 that was it. What made you decide to ultimately retire? Was it just the idea of you didn't get to the big leagues in 18, so you were at an age?
Yeah, I'd kind of long held that barometer. There were a few things that if I ever was not invited to a big league camp, if I ever went a season without playing in the big leagues, and I think the reality is, if I were 22 and single and in the minor leagues, I probably would continue playing. I don't love playing any less. I had 3 kids. I was away from home, and it was really hard to justify that. They were, you know, I've got twin boys. They were old enough to realize I was gone. They loved a road trip to go watch me play in Buffalo, but they didn't love leaving. And I didn't enjoy that either. You know, my wife is at home with 3 kids, and it just didn't make sense. I didn't see how I could properly prepare myself to give any likelihood of success in 2019. And I was never the most talented pitcher. I think I maybe tried to outwork my competition, and that wasn't going to be feasible. And so it was time for me to move on. And I actually, I miss playing, but I don't miss it in the same way that I thought I might. You know, it's not so much, you know, going to the field and just spending endless hours. I can do that now, right? I think it's, you know, some of that, like, immediate feedback and sense of accomplishment and working towards something, and I feel like I've kind of finally filled that void now.
One of your other teammates at Yale was Mike Elias, longtime executive of the Astros. Now he's the GM of the Orioles. He once said while you were playing that you would be a future GM. Is that something you thought about, getting into a front office? A lot of guys when they're playing, they don't really think that far ahead. Some of them said, maybe I'll be a coach, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll broadcast. Was a front office career something you thought about while you were playing?
I wouldn't say I thought I'm going to be a GM. I would say I had conversations, like, going back to Oakland with Billy about, you know, roster construction and certain trades and you know, why does everyone get placed on waivers in August, right? You know, so I think I had a natural curiosity about the way front offices work more so than trying to detail my career trajectory through a front office. You know, I mean, I suppose, like, do I want to be a GM? It's like asking someone in politics, do they want to be president, right? Like, right. sure, like, aim high, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know where this actually goes. But I can say, you know, I took a job in the front office last year and didn't have nearly as much intimacy with player development. And that's something that I actually regret a bit or am almost a little embarrassed by, just because I spent so long as a player thinking about the day when I'd be in a position to effect change. And there isn't a player out there that doesn't think he can do a better job managing spring training or a game or a bullpen session. You know, and I spent a year where I probably could have done those things and didn't. And so, you know, I don't want to characterize that as lost time, but there's a little part of me that thinks, man, like, I spent a really long time thinking about ways I could make the lives of players better, and I just didn't do that for a year.
When you were with the Twins a second time in 17, you said that there was a disconnect in the game between the analytics department and the execution among players. Eric Chavez said something similar. He said when he was in Oakland and Billy Beane was doing all this analytic stuff and Moneyball and everything else, the players had no idea what the philosophies were. It was, they just played and the front office sort of evaluated it in their own way. As the analytics has moved to the forefront of the game, how much of an issue was communication between front offices and clubhouse when it started, and how much better has that gotten?
I think it's gotten considerably better. I still think, you know, if you kind of look at the evolution of analytics in the game, right, and you start with the Moneyball era, and there were statistics that were valued, you know, by certain organizations, and they were able to leverage a competitive advantage for some amount of time before everyone started, right, and then the on base and slugging darlings became too expensive for Oakland to continue to leverage, right? So there was an asymmetry of information, right? And then there was, you know, then if we kind of fast forward probably 8 to 10 years, there's an asymmetry in technology, and certain teams were using technologies that others weren't. But I would say largely today, like, to your point, everyone's got Edgertronic cameras, everyone's got TrackMan, everyone's got Rapsodos, right? But we artificially implemented this finish line that was represented by finding a former player with an analytical bent who could liaise between a front office and players, or front office and a coaching staff, right? Like a guy like me who could take information from the front office and bring it to coaches and players in a way that the players can understand. But we decided that was where the game ended. Now we've identified a problem and we've delivered it to a player in a way that he understands the problem, right? But there is still a major problem. We haven't solved it, right? We've just given the player the information in a way he can understand it. But that, I think, is why coaches are still as valuable or more valuable than they'll ever be. They don't need to spend as much time diagnosing problems, but they can spend more time fixing them. And so, do I think it's gotten better? Absolutely. I think, like, we are much clearer and much more targeted in developmental deficiencies, but I'm still not sure that we've kind of reached the pinnacle of, well, if this is the problem, then this is the solution. There's still a ton of nuance in the day-to-day coaching of players.
You joined the Cubs beginning of 2019, Director of Strategic Initiatives. did you even know what your job was? Because you hear that title and you're like, okay, what exactly does that mean?
Right.
How was it explained to you by Theo?
Yeah, no, I knew that I had some interest in kind of evaluating some of our processes, determining where there was an opportunity to allow data to drive development and decision making. There were pretty broad responsibilities, but that was deliberate. I knew that I had spent most of my time kind of down this rabbit hole that is pitching, and I was interested in learning more about hitting, about defense, about the way a front office works, about how different departments collaborate and integrate. I was coming from a place where I could see what front offices were trying to do. But I was worried that it became more of a box-checking exercise to the extent that, hey, teams are building out their analytics departments. Let's do that by hiring a bunch of analysts. Or teams are moving toward this high-performance model that captures athletic training, strength and conditioning, nutrition, mental skills. Let's hire a director of high performance without the foresight of trying to determine how all of these departments are going to integrate. Right, and so I felt like there was an opportunity for me to say, like, okay, but understand that players are really perceptive, and they're going to realize that the R&D department is at odds with the field staff, or the high performance department isn't playing nice with the pitching coach, right? And like, how can we massage and smooth some of these things out? And I think like that's a battle where collectively everyone in baseball is still fighting.
Were there directors of strategic initiatives that you had admired? I'm kidding. I always like asking GMs. Were there GMs that you admired in the past? The Cubs are one of the teams in the majors with a quote-unquote pitch lab filled with the things you mentioned before, Rapsodo and Edutronic and TrackMan. Players over the years were sort of hesitant about buying into these types of things.
Sure.
You clearly not being one of them since you actually own your own Rapsodo. Have you found in the last year or two that players are buying in a little more and they're more open to what you guys are trying to accomplish with the pitch lab?
Absolutely. And I think that's a product of a few different things. The state of development is such that, whereas 20 years ago, credibility came with a playing career, right? If you played, then you were a good coach. Obviously, we know that's not necessarily true, but there's a ton of value in having played, right? I'm not here to devalue playing experience, but we also have to accept the reality that there are a number of players that are entering our organizations who have had their careers impacted as amateurs by guys who have never played, right? And you see this in social media and some of the different youth programs, right? There's hitting gurus and pitching gurus that may have never played, but they understand, they understand hitting, they understand pitching, and our players are going to see those guys. We just have to accept that. We have to embrace it. Once you've had your career impacted by someone who hasn't played, I think you start to kind of better appreciate like source blind information, right? And that's like ultimately where we should get guys. It doesn't really matter who's telling you the information. If the information is right, we should use it, and if the information's not, we should ignore it. So I think there's that. And then I also just think kind of generationally, like this demographic, this population is naturally inquisitive and curious, and they want to understand why, and they want to understand how, and data is a really valuable tool in helping us to bridge that gap.
After your one season in that role, a little restructuring in the offseason, and you're named to your current role as Director of Pitching and Special Assistant to the President and GM, Theo Epstein-Jed Hoyer. According to the team, your duties include the strategic management of the club's minor league pitching infrastructure. And the stories that were written when this all happened was, basically your task is to help develop more homegrown pitchers. How do you go about doing that?
If you know the answer, you let me know.
I'd be the director of pitching.
We've got some ideas, but I think what it comes down to is the draft, talent acquisition is still a little bit of a crapshoot. We don't really know definitively like who's going to make it and who isn't, and so we owe every player in our organization our best effort, right? We're trying to, our goal is being committed to provide the best path to get every guy to the big leagues. Now, statistics tell us that we're going to be largely unsuccessful, right? But it doesn't mean that we don't owe that to every player in our organization. And so, we've got a great combination of returning staff and new coaches who are committed and invested and engaged in this. And the beauty of this is they are 100% adamant about giving everything they have to every player here. And I think some of the traditional development models have been limited, and just limited by bandwidth. You know, you have a single coordinator, it's really hard to oversee 8-9 affiliates and, you know, 12 to 15 man pitching staffs on every one of those. So, you know, we're committed to empowering our coaches. You know, my job, I feel like, is not to micromanage, it's not to coach players, it's not even really to coach our coaches, it's to set organizational direction, it's to align behind some kind of unifying or overarching approach or strategy, and to allow our coordinators and coaches to impact our players.
When you mention, like, the idea of a single pitching coordinator for the organization, it's kind of antiquated in terms of not being able to get everything you need to get out of that job, and so you guys have changed that. How important is it for a front office in general to be forward-thinking and not just continue to do things because that's the way they've always been done? Because I feel like in baseball, for years, the answer to why do you do it that way was because that's the way it's always been done.
Right. Somewhere along the lines, and I'm not speaking specifically about this organization, but somewhere along the lines, it seems that player development turned into player preservation. We avoided making players better out of fear of making them worse. And I think the one perspective I can bring to this position as a player is trying to relay just how willing players are to take chances, to take risks, to move past things that didn't work and still be hungry for the next recommendation we have. Because every player here wants to get to the big leagues, right? And if someone were to have sat me down and said, your fastball just does not project as a playable pitch in the big leagues, but we have a program we can put you on that we believe will provide a non-zero chance of improvement that will get you there. Now, we can't handicap the odds, we can't make any guarantee, but are you willing to try that? I have a hard time believing that there's a player out here who would say no.
Right.
And yet, for so long, we've spoken on behalf of those players and decided, well, we can't take something to a player because what if it doesn't work? Or, you know, what if they regress? And it's like, well, if it doesn't work, we'll try something else, right? But, like, our goal is not to keep, it's not to make the best A-ball pitcher we can make or the best double-A pitcher we can make. It's to get guys to the big leagues. And I think somewhere we lost sight of that. And so just providing that perspective every day is something that we're trying to do here.
There's been a perception that front offices in the last 10, 15 years have been overstocked with Ivy Leaguers who were, you know, didn't play the game, maybe played in college or high school, but, you know, were not professional players, have business backgrounds, math backgrounds, whatever it may be. And there really haven't been that many players entering the front office stratosphere. You fit both profiles as an Ivy League guy, but as a former player, why do you think more players haven't pursued a front office path after their playing days?
You know, I'm not sure it'd be fair to speak on behalf of all players. I think, you know, it's traditionally it's been far more likely that a player ends his playing career and kind of stays on the field, and I think there's something comfortable about that. I think there's something really appealing and compelling about being in the trenches and competing every night, and that's not something that you can really ever replace from this perch, right? And so I think it's probably less about why don't players join front offices and probably more about why do players stay on the field. But I also think it's important to point out, at least from my perspective, I believe this idea that, like, traditional coaches or playing experience is no longer valued or it's being pushed out. I think maybe what has shifted is if you have to choose between, you know, your kind of analytically inclined business background executive or just a former player, 20 years ago you probably just picked the former player,
right?
And maybe now you pick the, you know, the analytically inclined business driven person. However, in an ideal world, you still have the blend of both. It's just really hard to find, right? But I believe, like, a shift in the kind of all else being equal has somehow manifested itself as baseball doesn't value playing experience or traditional coaches. And I would argue against that.
When Alex Cora stepped down or was let go by the Red Sox, one Boston writer was putting out potential candidates and floated your name as a possible target. Is managing anything that ever would appeal to you? Or is the idea of going back on the road and being away from your family what would keep you away from wanting to do something like that?
No, I mean, I really don't know where this path will lead. It's really humbling to kind of even just have my name thrown out. I'm not sure if you read the comments. I think it would be like,
I try not to read comments in general.
Named manager, I will never watch another Red Sox game. Like, I will end my MLB subscription, whatever, right? But
we don't want ending their MLB TV subscriptions.
There is certainly some intrigue around getting back on the field. I don't know if right now is the right moment. I don't know if I'm prepared to have success in those positions. I think, you know, kind of getting back to the, do you want to be a GM? Do you want to be a manager? I want to be successful, and I'm not sure right now I could set foot in the manager's, you know, in the manager's seat and lead a team. But certainly there's some intrigue in getting back on the field. I don't know if this is the right time personally, with family considerations, just in terms of like my own development as a leader. But I mean, I'm not gonna rule out anything indefinitely. I just don't think it makes sense to do that.
Ruling out medical school at this point, though?
Aside from medical school. I guess it'd be really hard to go home and say, okay, I'm not going to be home, you know, 4-year-old, 1-year-old wife. I'm not going to be home. It's like I was on a baseball schedule, but instead of getting paid, I'm just actually going to accrue more debt.
I'm going to pay people to do this.
Right.
I guess you kind of addressed this. So some people have pegged you as a potential future GM. You're still very early in your front office career.
Yeah.
Do you have goals beyond just helping the Cubs win a World Series?
Yeah, I mean, I think like if we can make our pitchers better, that's a win for us, and that's kind of where my head is right now. Like I said, I want to be successful in what I do. I don't want to just chase status or title. I'm further away from being a GM right now than I was at this time last year when I thought I probably could walk in and just do a job, right? It's managing any organization of this size with this many elite talents is really, really difficult. And I'm impressed every day that I speak to Theo and Jed. I watch the way Theo and Jed interact. And ultimately, that's why I'm here, right? I did have some opportunities to work in other organizations, but this is the one that felt like the right fit for me. So one day, would I like to be a GM? Perhaps.
Maybe President of the United States.
You know. Right. But I think right now, I'm really committed to the coaches that we hired, the coaches that are returning, the players that are here. You know, we had a number of people that, you know, kind of entrusted stability, personal considerations in me, and I want to make sure I'm honoring the commitment to them first.
Greg, I appreciate the time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Craig Breslow for taking the time to sit down for this week's episode of Executive Access. In our next episode, I'll be joined by Mariners Special Assistant to the GM, Tom McNamara. We'll discuss the art of scouting, the inexact science of the amateur draft, the chaotic nature of a draft room, and much more. You can search for Executive Access on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Art19, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and enjoy these conversations all season long. If you like what you hear, leave us a review while you're at it. We always appreciate those. And be sure to spread the word and tell all the baseball fans in your life about Executive Access. Until next time, I'm Mark Feinstein. Stay safe, everybody.